We have the last session. I said that in you and consistent. This is a very interesting and very wise subject. But like the leaders earlier, there's the subject of the great deal of visualizing and a large amount of scientific misunderstanding. About 1910, modern science became aware of the endocrine system. This does not mean they had not known about it before, but it had remained a comparatively quiet, dignified part of our anatomy, and was enjoying that exclusiveness and seclusion which the body seems to prefer. Then all of a sudden, glands began to be very important. And in the 20 years following 1910, the gland concept became high fiction. It was something like spaceships in the 50s and 60s. Almost anything that you couldn't understand or you couldn't explain was a matter of glands. Furthermore, a highly evolved technique for investigating glandular function and glandular structure began to appear. Scientific papers were numerous. A group of scientists who called themselves endocrinologists appeared in the field of medicine, and we had almost the equivalent of the modern psychologist and now the modern exponent of wonder drugs. As always, man just went to excess. This does not mean that valuable information was not gained. It does mean, however, that there was not adequate criticism, very little basic understanding, and practically no basic interest in the glandular problem except on the purely physical level. We had much discussion of glands and rejuvenation. We had glands advanced to explain the personality problems which are now in the province of psychology. In those days, a man was what his glands were. And whatever changes occurred in his life or personality or appearance, these changes were basically due to glands. One problem that confronted the endocrinologist from the very beginning was that one gland, possibly the most important of all, just simply refused to reveal its secret. And for the most part, the condition is the same now, although a good many years have passed. The pineal or pineal gland, either pronunciation is correct, located in the central part of the brain, still remains the mystery gland of the human body. We sense, at least we think we do, that this gland, as long as it remains the most mysterious, is in all probability the most important. There is talk about this being the master gland of all, but it simply remains, even today, so mysterious, so difficult to work with, that comparatively little important information has been accumulated about this gland. The others have given up some of their secrets, at least, and we do know what we suspected from the beginning, that they were there for a good reason. Nature does not put anything into the human body without a purpose. And man can take very little out of the human body without getting into some kind of difficulty. The various glands tied together into a kind of pattern certainly were focal points for the distribution of important secretions that affect health and well-being and contribute to a mysterious chemistry within the body. A chemistry which has as its essential purpose the maintenance of the equilibrium of function. The glands, therefore, act as regulators, distributors, integrators, organizers. And in their natural and proper functions, they are certainly of the utmost value. Yet with this general concept, we followed along the old accustomed way, which we are still following, to try to find out how we could influence these glands, how through various procedures we could become masters of their functions, so that we could direct, amplify, or reduce these functions by various scientific means. Here again, some definite good was achieved. And there are persons alive today in relatively good health who would not be here if it had not been for the endocrinologists. Sometimes we suspect, however, that there are some absences from among us that might be attributed to the same cause. So we are not certain that we are in the presence of a complete and undoubted blessing. The difficulty seemed to be in the early area of research that it was all carried on by this splendid and brilliant group of materialists who could conceive of nothing of importance except physical symptoms and physical syndromes of one kind or another. To these people, the glands were a new way of trying to bring health to man by merely perpetuating the functions of his body. It was assumed that if you can save the body, you can save all. That if you can keep the body alive, the individual is alive. Here again, there is a broad point of doubt, because there are many people whose bodies are undoubtedly functioning, and that is about all we can say for the individual. We were not at that time very much interested in something that has later gained in fascination, namely the problem of the extrasensory gamut in human consciousness. If we had been interested at that time and a little more sympathetic, endocrine research might have had a far happier, more brilliant existence. This does not mean that the subject is dead. It is far from dead. Work is continually going on, but it does not have the hypnotic fascination that it had in the 30s and 40s. It is now moderating into a general program in which the glands are included with other subjects as well worthy of further thought. We do not have the mania on glands that we suffered from at that time. If this mania had become a more aware of the large picture or total subject, a very great deal of progress might have been accomplished, and it is even possible that at least one world war could have been prevented if we had really understood the glands of the human body. But we did not, and we were contented merely to search for means of treating immediate problems. Among the valuable byproducts of this research, undoubtedly, was research into the problem of diabetes and the development of insulin therapy. This is the type of thing which may be pointed out as the best that was achieved. There is much more, however, to this great problem than the correction of physical ailments. Unfortunately, however, the public mind follows the scientific bent, and most people are far more interested in obscuring symptoms of existing troubles or of hopefully looking toward the remedying of some physical situation than they are in the search of the larger verities of human existence. So both supply and demand kept the entire research into the gland field largely on an objective physical level. Today we are probably more aware than ever before on a scientific level of the relationship between what we term consciousness and body. Now, of course, to the scientist, for the most part, consciousness is still a physical term. Mind is only a condition of matter. And in this thinking, we cannot entirely escape into the freer atmosphere of larger thinking. Still, however, we do have a new perspective, and that is the perspective of a person in a body. And we begin to realize that in some way this person must operate through the body which it inhabits. Therefore, all areas which may have a bearing upon this are becoming increasingly important to our thinking. The great French scientist whom we refer to in our book, philosopher-scientist René Descartes, was one of the first to express a series of rather noble thoughts bearing upon the relationship between consciousness and body. He declared that the anima, or soul, certainly operated through the whole body, through all of its substances, its organs, its propensities, and its functions. But although this could be rather immediately accepted by the thoughtful, there was another, more advanced question. If this operation was general throughout the body, there must be a controlling or directing center. Functions of all kinds arise from certain basic energy poles or fields within the body. Therefore, if the body is all responsive to soul, then there is this implication that there must also be a particular part of the body which is most particularly sensitive to soul, that there must be a headquarters, so to say, for this vast field operation. And it was Descartes' opinion that the pineal gland in the brain was this controlling center. He held this after a great deal of thought and consideration. He studied all of the principal centers of the body, the organs, the nervous system, the arterial system, and he finally concluded that the larger and more massive structures could not be the controllers, but rather were the large reservoirs through which these controllers operated. That in all probability, the controlling power would be posited in a comparatively small and sensitive area. Just as, for example, the very fact that man is alive is due to a very small and important area at the apex of the left ventricle of the heart. The area involved is probably not much more than the size of a small bean. Yet this is a controller, a very important dynamic. And if anything happens to this one controller, the rest of the body ceases to function. Descartes, continuing his analysis, came to the conclusion that in the brain there was an unpaired organ, that instead of the organ being polarized or with two essential parts corresponding to the right and left sides of the brain, there was suspended almost in the middle of the brain, suspended in a manner in which it was capable of motion within the brain itself. A comparatively small and mysterious body, which resembled perhaps a small pine cone, and that this mysterious body, with an independent motion, held in position only by certain arteries and veins and nerves, was, in his mind, the most likely organ or center by means of which consciousness was able to impinge itself upon the body as a living structure. Therefore, that life came essentially from the heart. But from this other center came the power which transforms a living thing into a thinking, conscious being. He probably, Descartes, was not merely conjecturing, not in the ordinary sense of invention. He was a very thoughtful man, a very widely read man, and a great student. There is no doubt in the world that he was well acquainted with the religious, philosophical, and scientific thoughts of ancient peoples. And while perhaps he did not have available as large an area of research as we have today, he had enough to convince him that throughout ancient religions and mystical philosophies, there was a lore or legendary by means of which the isolation of the area which he selected would be natural, reasonable, and probable. Perhaps Descartes did not even consciously do this, but out of his vast background, this thinking was almost inevitable as a subconscious process in himself. From the very earliest time, men have used the concept of the I, in this case E-Y-E, as a symbol of consciousness, of internal awareness. In India, an extra I, a third eye, is placed on the forehead or higher upon the head of a deity to indicate, one would say, a power of superior sight, knowing, or insight. In the religious mysticism of Christianity, the head itself is surrounded by the nimbus of sanctity. Now, Descartes was a Roman Catholic, and therefore it is quite reasonable and probable that he was aware of the ancient symbolism associated with the canonization of a saint. Now, all through art, not only Christian art, but also Buddhist art and the arts of other Oriental peoples, sanctification is artistically presented or represented by adding around the head of the person a halo. In the development of the idea of canonization, they've developed quite a science of halos. All halos, aureoles, and similar luminous envelopes or surrounding light patterns are according to certain rules or designs. If you study ancient art, you will see, for example, that the persons of the Trinity, representing the Godhead, if personified, are usually given a certain kind of halo. That the halo of Christ is different from that of any of his apostles, and that the halos of saints are again different from those of angels, archangels, or other so-called celestial beings. Descartes was undoubtedly aware that if he took the halo around the head and regarded it as an area or a circumference, and he placed a compass so that he could draw this halo, which the artist placed around the head, that the central point of his compass, upon which he was to base the circumference, would lie in the head, or approximate the position in the skull of the pineal gland. Therefore, that this luminosity was radiating from a center almost in the exact middle of the brain. Now, this luminosity we conceive of, probably, as being simply an art symbolism. And I think certainly it would be so regarded by most scientists. At the same time, these symbols are archetypal. They go back to a very ancient pattern in human thinking. Therefore, I don't believe that we can simply assume that these symbols are arbitrary. Rather, the ancient attempted to indicate by the halo or aura around the head a state of sanctity. He did not put this aura somewhere else. Strangely enough, he did not put it around the heart. Sometimes, of course, he will make a larger halo. And in Eastern, particularly Buddhist symbolism, it is quite common to find a double halo. One obviously from the heart, the other from the brain. These two halos form a very pleasant artistic design and are noted in the shrines and images of many of the Buddhistic divinities. However, the halo around the head is derived from rather ancient thinking and from a still older patterns of belief or attitude. In the Egyptian religion, for example, we find a definite use of a peculiar kind of ornament that is placed on the exact crown of the head, a tiny little mound-like structure resembling a tiny beehive. And on the top of this is placed, usually, a conventionalized lotus blossom or lotus branch. Now, we say branch, fully realizing that that is not the way we generally recognize a lotus. But in Oriental art, it is usually a peculiar type of hybrid in which the lotus symbol is combined with a type of stem and leaf that suggests the acanthus rather than the lotus itself. Now, in this particular case, the deceased person passing into the underworld has this peculiar device fastened to the top of the head. The deities involved are frequently ornamented with crowns or symbols. And these symbols include a mysterious something resembling a kind of antenna placed in the top of the crown of the deity, approximately in the same relationship as the feather in the hair dress of the Indian medicine priest. Now, in American Indian lore, the war chieftains always wore the bonnet. This was a circle, usually, of eagle feathers, forming a very elaborate headdress. This bonnet often also included an appendage of more feathers down the back until perhaps almost reaching the ground. But a mystic, a medicine priest, or a holy man could not wear this bonnet. That was the bonnet of the war chief. The symbol of the holy man was a single feather rising directly from the top back of the head, exactly where if the stem of the feather continued into the head, we would assume the pineal gland to be. This was a sign of divine protection. It was a sign of dedication to God. This feather, by the way, served a number of protective purposes. For in the old tribal warfare, the chieftain with the war bonnet was always vulnerable. Anyone who wanted to take a shot at him could do so. But it was very bad taste to shoot the man who had one feather in his hair, because it meant you were shooting a priest. Therefore, normally, no one attacked him. And actually, he never carried arms himself. He was sacrosanct. He was set apart. And to injure the agent of the deity was a very serious offense. Descartes also well knew that from very old times, the tonsure was an important symbol, not only in Christian religion, but in other religions. This consists of shaving or removing the hair from a small circle at the crown of the head. This was, again, a setting aside of the individual for religious purposes. It was a very peculiar but important symbol. Some feel that it was an effort to capture an idea, and that this idea was that the child's skull in small childhood or infancy did not entirely and immediately close, but that at the crown of the head through small childhood there was a soft area where the skull bones had not joined. And it was a belief among many gypsies and other people that all children were clairvoyant until this skull closed over. Therefore, again, there was something mystical about this area in the top of the head. Down in the Casa Grande area, in our own southwest, the dead were buried in what was called the embryo posture, which is a kind of knee-chest posture, as the embryo is supposed to be in the womb. This was in order to emphasize the belief that the dead person or deceased person was beginning a new infant life in the other world. Therefore, that he was being born into another world, and that the earth became the second womb of his life. When he was so placed, a bowl was inverted over his head, forming a kind of cap. But before this was done, a hole was knocked in the bottom of the bowl so that there would be a space at the top of the head through which his soul might escape. The belief being that the soul left the body at that area at the crown of the head. This, of course, is completely carried on in the religion and philosophy of Vedanta and Yoga. In the Mexican Museum of Archaeology in Mexico City, there is a magnificent monolithic head, probably of Mexican jadeite. This head is called Morning Star. It is more than twice life size, perhaps four times life size. But there never was any body with it, because the undersurface of it is also carved and figured. Where the neck would join, there are elaborate glyphs covering the entire bottom of the head. And the heads of this nature, even larger, have been found along the coast of Mexico on the Gulf side south of Veracruz. The top or headdress of this figure, Morning Star, is a magnificent sunburst resembling a many-petaled lotus, almost identical in design to that frequently found on the cases of Egyptian mummies. It is as though an inverted lotus bowl had been placed over the head. In the center of the area, where the petals came together, was an open circle, the Chinese symbol of life, the vacant center in the mysterious Chinese plaque, which was used to represent deity. And in the case of the mummy, the Egyptian mummy, this central circle was usually painted deep blue, an azure color, to symbolize heaven or life or consciousness. We can go through 50 such parallels, all of which, to a degree at least, were available to Descartes. Also, we have another entire group of symbols, referred to, of course, originally in the Bible. The mystery of the eye single, the mystery of the all-seeing eye of the Masonic lodges, the mystery of the same all-seeing eye that is found frequently in the artistry of cathedrals and other religious edifices, sometimes placed within a triangle being basically, for one reason or another, used frequently to describe the shape of the third ventricle in the brain. This eye single is a mysterious kind of eye. We do not know just exactly what the Bible meant when it said, "If thine eye be single, thy body shall be filled with light." But it doesn't apparently mean that we should close one eye and expect illumination through the other one. Nor does it seem to imply that there is any ordinary organ of sight that is single. The only eye single we can conceive of is the one that Descartes found, because it is the only unpaired organ in the brain. It is single. It also is composed of exactly, or very nearly exactly, the same materials as the optic nerve. Therefore, that it is a potential eye. And in a few small forms of life, I could suggest perhaps that the gasteropodia is one of them, if that will help anyone, that in this particular, very primitive forms of life, there are still cyclops. There are still forms of life today that have one eye. And where they have that one eye, it is certainly and undeniably the eye which is now represented to us by the pineal gland. It is not the type of eye that we otherwise have. It is also present under a thin veil in certain forms of horn toads. And it is present in the central upper part of the skull, not where the ordinary eyes of the creature would be. That all such facts are available, and many others, might well cause us to pause and inquire concerning this eye single. We find it occurring again in the Scandinavian sacred writings, the story of Odin and his single eye, how in searching for truth he went to Mimir's pool at the bottom of the tree of life, and there the god of all memories of things told Odin that he would give him the gift of insight if he would pluck out one of his eyes and cast it into the pool of memory. And when Odin had only one eye, he was enlightened. And from that time on, when Allfather wandered the earth, concealed as a man, he always allowed a heavy lock of his hair to fall over one side of his face to cover the fact that he had only a single eye. This one-eyed god has been called the sun god. And many ancient people insist that the sun deity is always properly represented with one eye. In the Kabbalah of the Hebrews, the God of Israel, which neither slumbers nor sleeps, is always presented symbolically in profile, so that only one eye is visible. The same situation also falls into the deck of cards, which was an ancient symbol. And you will note that in the court cards, some are in profile and some in full face. This is by meaning or purpose and not by accident. Thus we have enough lore and legendary to support Descartes' thinking and to suggest that in his time, lore and legendary were probably the most common sources of information available to him. That he would naturally derive from the backgrounds of things known that which he desired to know. The pineal gland, then, does still carry to us, and even to scientific men, the simple possibility that it could be an I. There is nothing to deny this possibility, that it is an I which has retired into the brain. And the brain has closed around it, and the skull has closed over it, and its sight power has ceased. We might also come to the rather simple supposition that if this was a prehistoric or primogenical eye belonging to some actually ancient and remote period and having no further use for man because his other eyes are so excellent and efficient, that this gland would atrophy. That which is no longer needed or useful to man seldom remains. But this gland does not do this. This gland remains in some way perfectly healthy down through time, although we don't use it. Its other services to mankind are sketchy, still the cause of continuous controversy. But that it is possible that this gland is an eye, that it does have enough structure to cause even a scientist to admit that it could possibly have visual power, but that this power is no longer active, but rudimentary traces of it can still be seen in reptilia even to the present time. All this adds up to one question. If this gland is an eye, is it likely, possible or reasonable, that nature preserves through the ages an eye that sees nothing? If a fish is left for a while in the cave of Kentucky or breeds there, after a few generations, these fish are all blind because there is no light. And this type of thing has been observed everywhere. But this eye in the brain does not seem to thus deteriorate. It leaves us with a very interesting speculation. Obviously, this eye is not particularly useful in adding up grocery bills or other, what we might term, highly practical pursuits. But we do have a term which comes from somewhere, and we're not even too sure where it comes from. But it has gained popular acceptance through time, and that term is insight. Now, if we have any part of man's optical equipment that could possibly have a different function or a different purpose to see something not otherwise visible, to see inward rather than outward things, to see qualitative rather than quantitative forms, to become aware, because our word see no longer simply means visual acceptance or visual reaction. When a man listens to what you say and he says, "I see what you mean," he is not looking at anything. It is insight that he is trying to tell you, that he has become aware. Descartes was convinced that this gland was a field of awareness, and that by its own proper nature, it was aware of those things of which man is not normally aware. And that man actually, for all of his objective awareness, is utterly dependent upon the contribution of a kind of awareness which he does not even recognize or understand, an awareness inward into value. This kind of sight is a sight into principles, and it may also imply more things. It may imply a sight outside of the sensory range of the five sensory perceptions that we now know. It may represent a connection to a vibratory band which man is unable to recognize, know, or cognize in any other ordinary sensory perception. This would be quite reasonable and philosophically sound, because it is obvious that man must have some cognition beyond senses. If he does not have a cognition beyond senses, he is doomed to live and die in a sensory universe with no means of escape. This was not nature's intention. The individual, in order to be more than he is, must have an awareness greater than is commonly available to him. He may not call upon this awareness. He may not even know that it exists. But unless it does exist, a very subtle evolutionary process in the life of the individual is frustrated. There is no escape from what Buddha called the machine of the five senses. This machine is a squirrel cage. And no matter how much we use these five senses, or how skillfully we use them, we can never see anything except that which is outside of us and around us. And from the reaction to the things brought to our attention by the physical senses, we create the mental instrument. And the mental instrument, therefore, is absolutely locked in the processes of the sensory perceptions. Thus, man can never know more than his five senses report to him. He can never come to a conclusion more vast than their testimony. He can never escape from their tyranny, and he can never avoid or evade the inevitable pressure of their authority. Well, this actually cannot be true. Consequently, man must have some means of cognition which is beyond the sensory perceptions as we know them. This means of cognition could very easily and very well be associated with the comparatively rare phenomenon of what is termed extrasensory perception. Now, extrasensory perception as a term is again suffering from this tremendous determination to make everything scientific. Extrasensory perception today is being approached as glands were approached 25 years ago, as an interesting and wonderful possibility by means of which we hope ultimately to cure the common cold, prevent mumps, or do something of that nature. Again, it has no essential meaning unless by means of it we can learn to read our neighbor's bank book or something of that nature. It is a scientific curiosity, and science is now sitting around trying to figure how we can capitalize it, how we can make it profitable, how we can use it to raise the standard of living, or also indirectly to raise the cost of living, although that is what might be termed a concealed purpose. Extrasensory perception is not merely what we commonly think of when we read an article on ESP. Extrasensory perception is the same thing that has been recorded from the beginning of time in the visions of mystics, the strange psychic experiences of saints, the mysterious revelational factor referred to by Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas, another great church philosopher, did as much as he could within the boundary of the framework of his permitted thinking. In other words, there were things he could not do, because in his time, men just did not do things that were contrary to their faith. It wasn't even a matter of persecution entirely. It was just simply that the human consciousness would not open itself to conscience reflexes by going outside of that which it regarded as right. Therefore, Aquinas was cramped a little in his philosophy and in his research. But he did recognize what he termed the validity of a sixth sense. We had the five ordinary senses, and he gave to us another sense, which he summarized in the concept of revelation. In other words, there was a way of apperceiving as well as perceiving. There was a way of knowing above as well as a knowing below. There was a knowledge to which man ascended, carrying with it a mysterious power or capacity within himself to receive from what perhaps Aquinas would term deity, a kind of instruction which he could receive entirely apart from the physical senses, which might allow him to read a book or listen to a professor give a learned address. Man with his outer ear could listen to the words of other men, but with an inner ear he could listen to the word of God, or what he termed God, which simply meant the voice of superior, that which was above or more subtle or more internal than the ordinary methods of accepting knowledge. Thus man could achieve through reason, which would be the climaxing of all faculties and their coordination, or he could receive through inspiration, which was a descent, a power of a divine life principle which could impart knowing. That which man gained, we will say for the moment, through his ordinary eyes, gave him a certain lockedness in matter. What we see, we believe. You cannot tell us this world is not here, we see it. You cannot tell us our friends do not look the way they appear to look, because we can see them. Also, we can see real estate. We can see a good investment. We can see all kinds of external things, families, friends, employment, all kinds of external situations are rationally conveyed into us through the sensory perception, and we accept them. We accept them with the peculiar intensity which has made materialism possible as a code of life. Without the tremendous validity of the physical sensory perception, man could never have been a materialist. Materialism was simply the fact that he wanted to believe that the world in which he lived was the world which he could see. And he could not rationally place an invisible world, which he could not see, above the visible world which he could see, as a level of value. Havelock Ellis, in his Dance of Life, explains a mystical experience which happened to him. To him, this was now a more authentic way of seeing. That which was internally experienced, both visibly and audibly, this unfolding of a factual power, a power so real that the things thus seen could be as indelibly fixed upon consciousness as the things seen by the physical sensory perception. Thus the internal experience makes man as certain of idealism as the outer sensory perception makes him certain of materialism. And having once inwardly seen, that man can no more deny what he has seen than the individual who sees outwardly and therefore cannot deny what he has outwardly seen. The intensity of this inner seeing also carries with it a dynamic which physical seeing does not carry. Plotinus points this out, where he says that although in his lifetime he had only on one or two occasions been given this moment of illumination, that from that time on the material world in which he lived could never again possess him. This experience inwardly was so great that even a long lifetime of habitual objectification back into the sensory world could never, for even a moment, cloud this other thing, this greater thing, which he had seen and known. Ellis tells us practically in the same words, where he tells us that this experience, which occurred to him in almost an inconceivably rapid instant of time, was of such tremendous intensity and validity that it could never be forgotten, and that as a person he could never have the attitudes again which dominated him prior to this experience, and it would not be necessary for the experience to be repeated. It was indelibly set upon consciousness. Now, such an experience as this must be regarded as either metaphysical or simply superphysical. If we wish to assume that without any peculiar or convenient machinery, by a grace of deity, by the intercession of some spiritual power, the perceptions of man can be miraculously quickened so that to a person, for no reason perhaps that he can understand, or for no rational purpose that he can define, a mystical experience can happen to him. Perhaps cannot happen to another person. So that by some miraculous intercessional power, 10 people, 100 people in 1,000 years can have this valid experience. This is one view on the matter. The other view, which probably has a little better philosophic content, is that these experiences so described are possible to all human beings, just as certain attainments in this world are possible to all human beings, but that only to certain persons, under certain conditions, do the experiences actually occur. Also, we know that within a body of society, we have one group which we may call normal. We have another group which lies below normal, which is a kind of subnormal pattern, representing psychological infancy or immaturity. That we then also, above normal, have an ascending order of superior types. Superior, not possibly according to some materialistic measuring rod, but superior either in psychic chemistry or in some internal spiritual grace. And that therefore some persons have developed or unfolded their natural potential so that experiences are possible to them at a given time, but that these experiences are possible to all men at some time, because the structure for the experience does exist in all. If such is the case, then the pineal gland is a prime candidate for being involved in this a superphysical situation. A situation that is not miraculous, is not mystical, essentially. Mysticism being only a term by which we try to explain something not generally understood or cognized. But remembering one of the really wise statements of Aristotle, where he says that when physics is properly understood, there will be no further need for metaphysics. In other words, metaphysics is merely a term to cover the undiscovered facts of physics, and that the entire procedure is a perfectly orderly one, and that this orderliness seems to suggest that the pineal gland is in some way a controller, that it's in some way a door by means of which certain experiences of inward consciousness may be transferred downward into objective existence. It is possible also that this gland is the secret of your sleep-dream phenomena, and that it is this gland which makes the dream remembered or forgotten when we awaken. It is this mysterious gland by means of which that which is not normally available to the sensory perceptions may be impressed upon them from within, particularly in the form of a visual or auditory experience. Thus, that certain things are seen inside. Other things are seen on the outside. And the inner sight may likewise be involved in your psychological processes. And it is very possible that your so-called hypnotic drugs and certain researches that are now being carried on in drugs dealing with psychic stimulus, that these operate because in one way or another they affect the rhythm of the pineal body. The problem of anesthesia and many others, even hypnosis, may lurk in this area where a tremendous amount of research must still be done. Now, we don't want to entirely devote ourselves to this one structure, but the reason why it seems most valuable to us is because it is still the one around which mystery lingers, which has not been as yet explained, and for which perhaps no adequate explanation can be discovered without the aid of mysticism or philosophy as we know these terms today. That they do represent, therefore, our present approach to this situation. Now, it is not known with certainty in the extrasensory perception field that the activity of this body can be stimulated. Most of the sensitives who have been worked with at Duke's and other places were natural. Their own abilities differed in various instances. A continuous practice or some special effort to increase the extrasensory perception did not generally succeed. Thus, the situation seems to be beyond ordinary control. And the answer must certainly be, therefore, that it is not specialization by volition, but some type of psychic chemistry resulting from the ennoblement of the entire life that must contribute to the intensification of this body. Physically, the pineal gland is associated undoubtedly with the controlling factors of growth. Therefore, this growth process, in the terms of the pineal, is not merely the distribution of certain secretions to cause the rapid development of body structure. This is only a secondary, perhaps negative, reflex of the gland's action. The positive aspect of it is that it is a releaser into the body of the consciousness factor.